Hello and welcome to Talking Capital. I'm Ian Barnard, CEO of CapGen. Each month, I'm joined by a member of our investment team or a guest from one of the investors in our universe to talk about the investment themes and opportunities that are available today to family investors. What is CapGen? We're a private investment office for families with capital. Our clients are sophisticated, internationally minded investors, and what we do is to help them make the most of their capital and to seek out investment opportunities across any asset class in any region of the world. So in the course of these episodes, you can expect us to cover a globally diversified portfolio of assets and sectors, be that bricks and mortar or derivatives. In summary then, this is a podcast where we discuss the questions that we think are playing on the minds of sophisticated long-term investors. If that sounds up your street, do please subscribe and you'll enjoy a new episode published on the first Thursday of each month. Welcome to Talking Capital. Today's episode is a discussion with our head of real estate here, Ross Davies. It's the second of our three-part series covering real estate. Last month, you will recall, Robert Sears, our CIO, and I spoke about the broad positioning of real estate in the portfolios that we look after and we help clients manage. And this month, we're going to go into greater detail with Ross. But zooming out from there for a moment, Ross, turning to you, could you start us off by just talking to us about where you see opportunities in real estate at the moment? As we heard with Robert last time, the sector has undergone enormous upheaval. I think the two big changes we're all really familiar with are the rise in interest rates off the very low base that we've seen really since the financial crisis, and then, of course, the COVID experience and fewer people going into offices less often. So two big things, and I'm sure many, many other things going on besides that. So Ross, if you could give us a general survey of what you think is going on and what you think the opportunities are.
Sure. Thanks, Ian. Broadly speaking, we've seen the decline in asset valuations plateauing. And actually, in some instances, the sort of green shoots of valuation recovery emerging. But it's fair to say that we're not out the woods yet for all assets. You've got to look across the different sectors and different geographies, and all of those are recovering in different forms and with differing velocities. Also, as you touched on, the availability of credit is a determining factor. And we're seeing lenders completely closed to some sectors and also actually the whiff of distress in some markets, which actually presents an opportunity, which we'll come on to. Looking across the UK, we think the industrial and logistics sector poses some decent opportunities, mainly driven by low vacancy rates in existing stock and also pretty robust tenant demand. The other sector, actually, which we think there are opportunities in, is the data center sector. And this actually spreads out of the UK and into Europe, where actually when you go into Europe, you tend to find the land is cheaper and the energy is cheaper. And this coupled with the desire by providers to onshore data and bring it back to Europe is making quite a compelling business case. We met actually with one developer who talked us through where your photos are stored on your phone. And the stat was for every 10 photos on your phone, about 7 of them are currently stored in United States-based data centers, which is something that providers are looking to bring back to the UK and Europe. And it chimes with this sort of nearshoring, onshoring theme that we're seeing, which is also driving the industrial and logistics centers. Other sectors which are showing interest, I think, are very, very prime central London, well-located offices. There's an acute shortage of decent space, and we're seeing good rental growth, which obviously helps with an underwrite. And I think the other theme which is emerging, we've seen this in some of the overseas geographies that we tend to operate in, and that is that there's a lack of overseas capital in certain international markets, which is leading domestic players to re-enter those markets because the pricing is now attractive enough for those domestic players to re-enter. And that can often in itself be quite a compelling reason to re-enter.
Gosh, there's lots there, Ross. I'm going to start with your last point first, if I may. So you said that Opportunities are returning because international capital has withdrawn from some markets. You also mentioned earlier the central London real estate, high quality could look attractive. Is that what you think you're seeing here in London? Because if you look back over the, well, many years, actually, the marginal buyer of a high quality asset in central London tended to be an overseas source of capital. The traditional UK buyers, the pension funds and insurance companies, had seemed to be largely absent from the market for many years leading up to COVID. And you'd seen various sort of pools of buyers. I think your Korean pension funds have been there. We'd seen quite a lot of Chinese buyers. We'd seen GCC buyers. Can I link those two? Do you think that international capital is no longer bidding for central London assets, or were you talking about markets outside the UK?
Yeah, I think London's the anomaly because London is still rich with international capital and pools of liquidity. It's other markets that we've looked at globally or have operated in globally, which are now showing pretty big reversions. And I think if you touch on London, actually what we're seeing is still waves of international capital prepared to invest in London, but that capital is more willing to align with local partners as it understands and appreciates it needs to have somebody on the ground who is fully au fait with what is happening in terms of that localized market.
We touched on, moving on to another one of your themes, we touched on the rise in interest rates and the post-COVID working patterns as a couple of challenges for real estate, but you identified some positive dynamics. One of them clearly is around the online shopping, which has given support to the sort of industrial logistics story, not just in the UK and in Europe, but generally across the Western world and elsewhere. This secular growth in demand for large sheds to support distribution through online portals rather than through retail. But you also mentioned data centres there. So your feeling, Ross, is that Europe can be attractive as a location for data centres because of cheaper land, cheaper electricity?
Yeah, I think those two points are valid. And what we're starting to see is clients coming to us and asking for exposure to that particular sector. And it's very difficult as a private investor to take full exposure to a speculative data center development because the amount of capital required is really quite considerable. We're talking many hundreds of millions of euros. And we therefore tend to direct our clients towards operators or funds who are active in that space where you can basically get a bite-sized exposure to a speculative or pre-let data center that's under construction.
And by comparison, the UK is less attractive?
Not necessarily. I think the UK is more difficult in terms of planning regime and power connectivity.
Yeah. So the opportunities are there, but it's in Europe, but it's hugely difficult to access on your own as an investor because the capital sums are so massive. So what, Ross, the solution there would be some sort of fund vehicle?
I think it would. And going back to your question about, you know, where the opportunities are, yes, there are opportunities in the UK, there's opportunities in Europe, but actually there's other drivers, such as we're working with one partner in Europe who is specialising in Southern Europe because of its connectivity into the Middle East and Africa.
Very good, thank you. Can we just touch on the US? So we've talked a bit about the UK, we've talked a bit about Europe. You did mention that 7 out of 10 of the photos on our phones are housed, if that's the right word, homed in the US, currently in US data centers. But what else is going on in the US, Ross? Is it a carbon copy of Europe in terms of the drivers, both positive and negative demand, or other differences?
I think as ever, the US tends to be slightly more extreme. When we look at where those opportunities are, we're seeing really quite sort of compelling reasons to look closely at, say, the multifamily, office and industrial logistics sectors in certain parts of the states, where we're seeing the sort of mix of developers who are struggling to lease up their existing product. They're coming up for refinance, and also in markets where there's actually quite a lot of oversupply. So to give you an example, if you're in Austin, Texas, about 1 in 5 apartments are currently vacant. Rents are down between 15 and 20%. So that is a big headache to a developer who's currently under construction, who is about to deliver supply into something of a distressed market. That's not just multifamily. If you look across then to the industrial logistics sectors in Georgetown, you're looking at vacancy rates around 20, 25%. In Salem County, you're between 30 and 40%. So again, it's not a case of us saying, go in and buy something because there's distress there. It's actually looking at buying the better product with a better developer, but a developer who's probably coming up to refinance or facing issues with their lender.
So yes, exactly that truism that cheapness doesn't mean good value. Cheapness can sometimes just mean cheapness and deserve cheapness. So because prices are down doesn't mean that that's an opportunity. It could be, as you say, that there's just massive surplus capacity. And I guess then the value creation in all of this is spotting the areas of cheapness that represent good value from the areas of cheapness that just represent, you know, no value.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you look at those weak fundamentals and you've got a whole host of 2021, 2022 construction loans, which are coming up for refi in 26 and 27. And then in the last, you know, whatever it is, 24 months, you've seen this massive adjustment in interest rates going from the low zeros to north of 5%. It is no surprise that the US traditional lenders are starting to lose patience and actually in some instances probably starting to panic a bit, which we think opens up opportunities in opportunistic credit, structured capital solutions, and again, rather than just doing a straight equity play because it looks cheap.
Okay, well, so that's very helpful and probably a nice segue into our second topic. So you've run through, broadly speaking, you know, where you think opportunity might be. Not definitely is, but might be. Let's come at that now, at right angles, if you like, which is the investment selection side of what we do. So there's a, you know, where's the opportunity lie, and then there's the body of work of looking at what you can actually buy in the market and seeing where they intersect. Because just because you perceive there's opportunity, it doesn't necessarily mean that you can buy. You can only, after all, buy what's for sale. So, Ross, perhaps you can talk a bit about that process. So you've got the identification, broadly speaking, of areas of possible opportunity, and then you've got the, you know, adjacent but slightly separate body of work, which is looking at, okay, what is available, what is there in the market, what looks well-structured, well-organized, has the right people involved. Can you talk us through a bit that process, and I guess also lots of questions here all at once is that choice between doing something directly and doing something through a third party manager?
Yeah, I mean, taking a step back, we are offered access to multiple real estate funds probably on a daily basis. Some of them are repeat funds, some of them are first time funds. And if we've identified a certain sector or geography as, in our view, having the potential to generate outsized returns, and if it's through assets which we feel that we cannot target through our own direct real estate program, then often a fund, as you touched on, or co-investment vehicle, is often the ideal way of capturing that exposure. When I look at our involvement in real estate funds, it tends to take three sort of broad approaches. Firstly, some clients ask us to target certain sectors, and we'll go out and find for them the best fund in order to achieve that exposure. Secondly, other clients will bring us a specific fund and ask us to DD the opportunity for them. And thirdly, if we've independently identified a sector that we want to gain exposure to, we'll find the fund, DD it, and then propose it to our clients.
And how, and before we come back to funds for a moment, Ross, how do you think about direct opportunities vis-a-vis a fund? What is, I mean, is, do you have a sort of rule book that guides you, you know, well, in this particular case, I think the answers go direct. In this particular case, I think the answers to go through a fund. How do you work that through in your mind?
I think there's various factors at play. And I would start with this idea of generalism. And we are emerging from a market where in an abundance of cheap credit, you could be a generalist and you could track a market and make money. We're now in a world of specialism, and you need to be very, very focused and very talented at doing a specific thing within real estate in order to create a specific product in a specific locality, which will then make you money. And it's therefore a case of looking for managers or direct deals which are targeting a specific thesis.
So that's quite profound in a way, isn't it, Ross? I think you're saying, and I guess, you know, maybe not the first time it's been said, but it doesn't undermine the importance that this was a sector that had a tailwind, and it's now a sector that has, you know, at worst, at best, no wind, and at worst, a headwind. And therefore, if you're relying on external factors, the wind, to sort of move you in the right direction, that isn't there anymore. You've got to stretch in the analogy. You've got to row yourself.
Yeah, I think you do. And actually, to give you an example of that, just take the REIT market. So it is wrong to assume the same fundamentals apply when looking across all geographies and all sectors. Within the REIT market, for example, majority of UK REITs are trading at significant discounts and net asset value. Go across to Switzerland and you've got REITs trading at double-digit premiums to asset value.
So yeah, so there's no sort of single big picture view. But can, just taking that for a moment, Switzerland, they're trading at a premium, which is always pretty off-putting. And I know you and I have done a bit of work on that for a client recently. So this is a very vivid memory for us. But so we talked about direct, we talked about funds, and you've thrown REITs in there. Can REITs have a part in portfolios, do you think?
I think they can. And this is something we've touched on before, where this, again, going back to specialism, you're seeing REITs becoming specialists within certain sectors. So if you think there's growth to come from telecoms or industrial logistics, you can target specific REITs to give you that return. Obviously, the advantage of the REIT market is you've got greater liquidity. But you could then make the argument, how fluid are those REITs in targeting new sectors or new opportunities if they're becoming very siloed and very specialist from the outset? So I'm just going to give you an example of, we've had two funds independently of each other come to us in the last month in the States who suddenly said, believe this or not, the Washington trade is looking very, very interesting. So we're seeing office space in Washington experiencing significant corporate demand as corporates flock to secure physical presence near the gates of power. So it sort of flies against all the other office markets in the US where you're struggling. You're seeing decent demand off the back of a Trump trade.
Interesting, because prima facie you would have imagined that demand for office space in Washington is down because of the impact of DOGE, but you're saying actually the countervailing pressure, which is people wanting to be present in Washington because of the arguably whimsical features of US policy at the moment, means that that actually net demand's looking stronger.
Yeah, exactly. And the telecoms mast REIT provider isn't going to pivot suddenly into Washington offices.
So there we are. We've got direct deals, we've got funds, we've now got REITs thrown into the mix, and you've talked about the number of opportunities we see and we do. And, you know, if you're in the marketplace as someone who is known to deploy capital, those in search of capital have a very effective way of finding it. So we do see a lot of flow. As you and your colleagues, Ross, are triaging this flow, can you talk us through the sort of key things you look for that allow you rapidly to put something on the possibly in tray, definitely on the out tray? I mean, is it just you look at the opportunity they're targeting, or is it the amount of time they've been in existence, or is it perception of the quality of the management team. What are those few key things that allow you to make rapid decisions about what you'll continue to look at and what you'll discard?
Let's just start from a point of assuming that the governance is good, the LPGP alignment is correct. Then for us, it is very much about the management team, because you need individuals who have experience and individuals who are motivated to unlock opportunities. And you need an ability within that team to generate deal flow. And there are varying forms of deal flow. Not all deals are good in that flow. So you need a team that can A, generate the deals, and B, then discern which are the decent deals and the deals to sort of discard. And I think as you get more experienced sort of deal origination teams, and especially in the markets we're going into in the US at the moment, it is not about bidding on properties to take equity positions in assets that are on the open market. It is about unlocking a flow of deals from, in my view, the banking sector. So these are banks who have loans coming up from maturity or loans which are in default and are looking for quiet, structured, easier ways of offloading those loans. And those loans will be offered to those with whom they have relationships, and they'll be offered to existing, mature management teams.
Ross, wonderful. Super helpful. Thank you very much for joining us. And we look forward, hopefully, to you joining us again in a month's time. Thank you.
Thank you.
A link to CapGen's privacy notice and full terms can be found in this podcast summary description and on our website.